I was reading a really thoughtful, it was quite short, but it was a pretty complicated piece this past week about the process that so many indigenous folks are going through with working out their own relationship with Christianity. You know, from my particular limited perspective, one of the things that continues to astonish me when I have conversations with indigenous friends and acquaintances that are in this process is that they're bothering. Like the colonial project feels like it's so often been so destructive in this regard that I'm like, okay, you know, move on. You know, like why are you even doing this? And when I actually have those conversations, I realize I'm actually talking about something really embedded and some aspects of which remain very precious to people. And so the process is a really complex one. And this piece was about that. I can only imagine it personally. And so those conversations are essential to me trying to see through a lens that isn't the one that I carry with me. In this particular article, the issue was focused on a northern Nunavik community where historically the Anglican denomination had arrived there from Britain. They'd brought a metal church from Britain, like shipped it over, a Quonset and sort of structure, and built it in this community, and become an important part of the community life. And from a present-day vantage point, that piece of history, so the community, the congregation is no longer there, but the building is still there. And it's kind of being repurposed as a museum, as a bit of an interpretive center of that period of history, which is an interesting project. From the present-day vantage point, that history is now also an expression of colonialism, and as are the remains of the Hudson's Bay store in that community, which arrived a few years later and became a kind of important outpost for a bunch of things, colonialism among them, but also supplies of certain kinds for people from those communities that were moving through the area. So, again, that's sort of this blender, right? Anyway, that conversion of the Anglican church into a museum and interpretive center exists in this complicated space of both marking that colonial legacy so that it doesn't, you know, so we don't hit the repeat button on that one, but also providing a physical space for artifacts from the peoples of that area, from their history and their stories. So interesting intersection. The mayor of that community, Anthony Itushat, calls the project in this article, he calls it bittersweet. And he talks about how difficult it is for present-day community members to reckon with their own past, their own roots, and what their religion is. He says it this way in the article. He says, knowing today that there's like 100 different types of religions, Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, where do we fit in as Inuit people? Just because the Anglicans got to us first doesn't mean they're right. Yes, that's true, isn't it? I would say that in this story at least, just because they got to us first doesn't mean they're right. That is true for both the religious ideology represented in this particular case by Anglican missionary endeavors, and it's also true for capitalist ideology, in this particular instance represented by the Hudson's Bay commercial initiatives in that community. And when you look at it from the vantage point that the article does, both of those initiatives can probably most easily be understood as fundamentally self-interested, that they weren't essentially, in the long view, there for the people who were, you know, buying the product. There's something else that motivated them. We'll come back to touch on the why of that before we're done today. That's only one lens, I know. That's why I said from the outset, this is a complex story, right? Anyway, that complex version of these stories, the way that I tend to hear them is I hear them brought into the conversation primarily by Indigenous voices. And those voices for me include moments like one where recently where I heard William Prince talking about how the problem isn't, as he's experienced it as an Indigenous person growing up inside of Christian missionary endeavors in Indigenous communities. As he talked about it, he said the problem isn't with the teachings of Jesus, which he regards as quite beautiful. It's where it goes sideways is when indigenous people are regarded as needing, and he's very specific about the phrase, a Lord and Savior. Now, if you grew up around that language, it can be pretty hard to stand back from it and try to hear it from another point of view. But maybe, if we can, try to imagine the possible impact of being told that you need to be ruled over. Because in the English translations in which we have the Christian narratives, that's feudal Middle Ages language. That's the period of history the language comes from. And in that period of history, that's feudal, that's what Lord means. Right? So we might have had all these religious experiences around that where that word's been dressed up in other things, but that's the roots of the language and that's the root meaning of it. And so imagine being a people group and having someone else come to you and say, you need to be ruled over. Or that you were personally, culturally, and spiritually lost without the white man's God. In other words, you needed to be saved. You needed a savior. You needed to be saved from what you already have. Don't want to speak for anybody else, but the question comes to mind, does that strike you as infantilizing or disempowering at all? It's worth musing about, seems to me. Or to think about it another way, what kind of outpouring of grace does it require for a people to continue to offer a welcome to another group of people whose primary legacy among them is broken promises, abusive relationships on both a personal and structural level, and attempted genocide in the name of their God and greed for raw resources? That's pretty harsh, I realize. But it is another possible way of thinking about what it means to be grateful for living on Treaty 1 land, which we all do. Here's a question from within the Christian tradition. In these sorts of stories that I've sort of been broadly referencing in the last few minutes, which characters in those stories are really the characters that Jesus was talking about when he talked about the least of these? Can we be much more diminished as human beings than if we are treating another human being as less than human? Can we be more least than, less human than that? Maybe the least of these, maybe the characters in these stories that need to have the practical grace extended to them the most, aren't the characters the colonists regarded as savages, but the other way around. If you're someone that thinks that the teachings of Jesus might have something good to offer the world, whether you think of him as one person of the Trinity, as a Jewish rabbi, as a homeless itinerant radical, or as a mythical figure, whatever, there's a range of possibilities. But if you're somebody that thinks that from within whatever lens you're viewing that story, there are also things worth sharing with the world that are good, then it might also be worth reflecting on who is truly serving divine intentions best at particular moments in history. Which is what Jesus said is happening whenever anyone does what is right by another person to whom he refers as the least of these. Sort of stands all those teachings on their head compared to how I was taught about them, at least. Anyway, that all just kind of poured out of me when I sat down to write this week. That's what was in there. I could have filtered it more. I don't feel like I need to do that in this community. That I realize that, you know, that's not a given, and so it might not resonate with you at all. I appreciate that that might be the case. As always, I think it's important to, in a community like this, I mean, I think this is always important, but I would love to imagine that this is a place where this is possible. I think it's important to take in what we're ready to take in, and if we come with a beginner's mind and heart, if we come open to acting in faith by leaning into what we don't know, rather than just reinforcing what we do know, then we're available to pick up what is ours to pick up and not pick up what isn't. I think if we weigh big questions that way, we're much more likely to come away with what our spirit is ready for rather than a load of shoulds and oughts and relatively useless guilt and shame. As always, being open requires making space. It doesn't just happen. So I want to invite us to take a few moments to do that together. So let's take a few moments to breathe together. And I'm going to invite us, if we choose to join with this part of what we're doing together, to do it however you want. It's an invitation to stillness. The stillness, for those of you that are both in the room and listening by live stream or later on the podcast, will include inevitably some of the happy sounds from downstairs. This is part of our environment when we're still today. All right? Let's just take a moment to breathe and be still together. Thank you. I say thank you at the end of those every time, and I don't know if I've ever said why, but it's because I regard stillness together, like I regard anything communal, as a chosen gift, not a given. And so I'm grateful to have shared silence and the keeping of space together with all of you this morning again. Thank you. All that stuff that we were just considering about stories and history and all of that, it's quite directly tied to our ongoing exploration of the relationship between doubt and faith. And again, I know I've said this before, but doubt and faith, not doubt and the faith. It's an important mind shift, because faith is not contained by a particular set of beliefs. Faith and the faith are not the same thing. Except in the most personal sense of, this is the particular faith I hold. This is the faith that I hold. The faith often becomes a phrase that eliminates all the others, invalidates all the others that are not like the person speaking. So to me, that's an important mind shift. This might be about Christianity, this exploration for you, and it really might not. And if it's not, and it used to be, which I think is the case for lots of people in this community, I think it's important to know that you have a lot of company when it comes to the process of sifting and sorting what kind of beliefs you can live with and what kind of beliefs you think might make the world a better place for everyone, at least to the degree that it's up to you and I. And many of those that keep company with folks that are sorting that kind of process are coming from personal experiences with religions that are not Christianity. Like this deconstruction experience that so many of us can identify with, there's absolutely nothing uniquely Christian about that. Like, this is just happening across all of the world's religions at the moment. And that's not I'm not making that up. I'm not going to take the time to back it up, but I would encourage you to speak to any peer in this cultural framework that grew up in another religion and ask about their process. And it won't be long in those conversations before you feel like you're talking to yourself if you're deconstructing. Like, you feel like you're having the same conversation with somebody else who did not grow up with your religious framework. There's the matrix of factors that are leading to this experience at this point in history is enormous and more shared than many of us imagine. But it's hard to imagine when we're deconstructing what we grew up with, right? When it feels like this is all about... Cheryl, I won't do the details here because we didn't discuss this, but we ended up having this conversation this morning about these expectations about going to church, right? And this experience of Sunday morning, you get up, you get it, you know, you get dressed a certain way. You for sure don't look like you just rolled out of bed, you know, like you gotta, why? Well, it's church. Maybe it's about community. Maybe it's about expectations. Maybe you got the religious version of why you should comb your hair, because you're going to the king's house. You're whatever the imagery was of, this is a special place, a special time, a special community. So you bring your special self to it. And when we start deconstructing, we can start to feel like that's all just about shoulds and oughts. And I'm not interested in showing up for that. And that can make it hard to kind of imagine what one might show up for of one's own volition that we desire. I have yet to have a conversation with anybody who's done work with a therapist, for example, on unraveling some of this stuff, who doesn't end up talking to me about the moment in those conversations where the therapist looked at them and said, well, what do you want? Because in the end, you have to live with this. What do you want? Not what should you do? Not what does your mother expect? Not what's the tape loop playing in your head that says you're going to burn in hell if you don't dress a certain way on Sunday? Not that. What do you want? And that's the conversation, I think, in lots of ways that is part of deconstruction, right? And it's very occupying. It's very hard to sort of imagine somebody else having the experience we're having, even in general ways, when we're in the midst of it. But people are. People are. The world's a big place. Lots of ways to believe in it, and there are people exploring what they believe in, all of them, many of them having the shared experiences of realizing that the beliefs that they were handed aren't working for them anymore, even while they may still see beauty in aspects of those beliefs. Here's a fascinating thing about that big world of exploration. More often than not, I believe that the core desires are shared ones. The structures might be very different, not least of all because they've been formed in other cultures and under unique circumstances, and so they speak to different questions. But underneath all of it, there is often a shared set of human longings that can guide us toward one another as people. I won't get into this story this morning, I'll tell it another time, but I had a fascinating conversation this past week, yesterday, in fact, with one of the smartest scientists that I personally know. This guy is brilliant at what he does. And if I told you what his sort of public role is, you'd probably recognize it. But somebody who's also deconstructing. And we were talking about how the language of theology and the language of science are like these different lingos for the same kind of search. Anyway, another day. But that shared ground is enormous in this. I really believe that. Anyway, I want to illustrate this a bit more before we go on with sort of filling in some of the boxes in that stage four schema, because without this shared terrain, without this sense that there's shared terrain, and this stage four actually doesn't make a lot of sense. Anyway, I want to share a story with you that I think might help open up what I'm trying to get at. This story comes from a celebrated American writer named Naomi Shihab Nye. And I'll read you the story first as she writes it, and then a little more about the author. So this is taken from Nye's work, Into the Wild. Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal, after learning my flight had been delayed 4 hours, I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of gate A4 understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, one pauses these days. Gate A4 was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor, wailing. Help, said the flight agent. Talk to her. What's her problem? We told her the flight was going to be late, and she did this. I stooped to put my arm around the woman and spoke haltingly. Shudawa, shubikuk, habiti? Stani shwe, minfadlik, shubitsiwi? The minute she heard any words she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for major medical treatment the next day. I said, no, we're fine. You'll get there just later. Who's picking you up? Let's call him. We called her son. I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and ride next to her. She talked to him. Then we called her other sons just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad. Then we called my dad, and he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, they had 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took up 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling of her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade mamul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, from her bag, and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There is no better cookie. Then the airline broke out free apple juice from huge coolers, and 2 little girls from our flight ran around serving it, and they were covered with powdered sugar too. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing with green furry leaves. Such an old country tradition. Always carry a plant. Always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late and weary ones, and I thought, this is the world I want to live in. The shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those other women too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost. Oh. Don't know how many times I've read that story. It kind of wrecks me every time. As you can probably gather from the piece itself, Naya has some Arabic ancestry. Her father was a Palestinian refugee to America. Her mother was an American of German and Swiss descent. And so she spent her adolescence in both Jerusalem and San Antonio, Texas. I don't know. I've never been to San Antonio, but I've been to Jerusalem, and I can imagine San Antonio. So that's quite a contrast, I think. Anyway, her BA is from Trinity University in San Antonio. She knows deeply and personally what it's like to live in a world of difference. And that's something that in her body of work, she seems both able to lament and celebrate. It's pretty interesting. In her first full-length collection, which was called Different Ways to Pray, and this is a while back already, that came out in 1980, she explores the differences between and also the shared experiences of cultures from like California to Texas and from South America to Mexico. The community she grew up in San Antonio, most of her neighbors were of Mexican descent. And so, but she was, you know, of this mixed Palestinian, Swiss, German, like, so it's quite the pastiche. Anyway, there's a poem in that collection called Grandfather's Heaven. And in that poem, there's a child's voice that declares, Grandma liked me, even though my daddy was a Muslim. And one reviewer of that work observed that with Nye's acceptance of different ways to pray is also her growing awareness that living in the world can sometimes be difficult. In the midst of that awareness, perhaps because of that awareness, in the piece that I read to us all, Nye says, so like, listen to this again, like with that in mind. I looked around that gate of late and weary ones and I thought, this is the world I want to live in. The shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. This shared world in which no one needs to be apprehensive about any other person, that is the worldview that is at the center of what stage 4 invites us to lean into. Even once it occurs to us that the work of both making and living in such a world might actually be quite difficult. It might actually be pretty daunting. Anyway, what I want to do standing on that is get into a couple of the particulars of this stage to see how they might contribute to that shared world ideal. You might have noticed I'm not especially inclined to just roar through the list. I think every one of these ideas expands outward if we let it. And so I want to always introduce them that way, with expansive ideas, and then let's talk about the identifying phrases and words by all means, you know, but let's not get stuck there. Those are entry points, and I hope that this can help them feel that way. Anyway, last week in stage 4 we considered that in that stage we find ourselves guided by our search for an integrative or holistic perception. So when we started talking about what's the 30,000 foot experience in stage 4, that's it. Integrative and holistic is our keywords there. And because of the sorts of things we end up exploring and our search for that, our focus tends to be on things like inclusion and transcendence. And so last week we touched on the possibility that inclusion might be the key that actually unlocks transcendence, or perhaps conversely, that exclusion can rather thoroughly get in the way of transcendence. That if our ordinary is constantly othering and excluding, then rising above that, which is what to transcend means, rising above that, if that's our ordinary, might not lift us much higher than basic civility, which I think most of us would regard as a good thing, but not necessarily a transcendent experience, right? So there might be some gaps there. Anyway, in that process, what might motivate us? What might kind of put juice in our batteries for this? In stage four, a big chunk of what tends to motivate us is that we want to find connections between things. We are looking for a way to see things as whole rather than as disintegrated. We're trying to find ways to see things as interwoven or being in relationship with one another rather than as competing forces or competing ideologies even. This is not about not acknowledging difference. It's about seeking commonality. That sentence doesn't even make sense if you're in stage two. I understand that. It's a different perspective. We want to be part of initiatives that make connections. We ourselves in stage four tend to want to be contributors rather than bystanders. This is a really interesting shift from the ideas of stage three, where we're often so busy deconstructing that we find choosing to engage with others in shared initiatives quite difficult sometimes because we're suspicious of the sharedness, because we've experienced sharedness as a weapon as well as a gift, you know? And it makes it hard when we're taking that all apart and trying to figure out what to do with it to kind of come to something that might be shared and go, is this just going to turn into that? Is this bait and switch? Is this the part where I get sucked into the beauty of community and I love these people and they love me and that all feels so great, and then somebody like hauls out the boilerplate of belief and hits me and mine over the head with it and says, you can't actually get past the threshold of really being inside unless you believe the right thing about this, and then it's over. Is this that? So stage three we're busy with is this that work, and it makes it very hard to turn this corner. But we can get tired of that too. We can just become weary of deconstructing, as we talked about a few weeks ago, deconstructing our own deconstruction, start to be suspicious of our own activities in this regard and go, yeah, but I'm longing for some things that I sense other people are longing for too. What does it look like to find the connection to that? What does it look like to contribute to making connections like that? I heard a fascinating documentary this past week on the work of this is the first time I'd ever encountered this person's thinking. It won't be the last time I encounter it because I'm deeply intrigued. A neuroscientist, psychiatrist, a guy named Dr. Ian McGilchrist from the UK. And I'll just touch on this and move on to the implications in our setting. But the implications are many. The core of his argument is that many of the problems that our society faces stem from the fact that we've been working in many ways with this particular notion of the way the left and right hemispheres of the brain function. And we've privileged the left hemisphere's functions and diminished the right hemisphere's value because the left hemisphere tends to focus on things like the logic and the rational and the strategic and so on. And those things, when we've applied them to the problems that we face as humans, we've had some good success. We've become wealthy. We've become powerful. We've become comfortable. And so we've privileged that. The right hemisphere is where the creative, imaginative, intuitive functions tend to have their home. And for a long time, we've had this brain model that says, actually, the left hemisphere is the one that we should default to in viewing the world. And the right hemisphere is kind of like, that's nice, you know, because it doesn't actually give us our view of the world. And his research would say something profoundly different than that. He would say, we actually don't have a left hemisphere and a right hemisphere at all. He uses rather radical, I mean, we do physically, but that functionally, we actually have two brains. And they both do everything. But they do it differently. Fascinating idea, because under that idea, both our brains have a view of the world, but those two views of the world are profoundly different from one another. And if they get out of balance, the way they do if we have a brain injury, for example, in one hemisphere, we can see how people with a brain injury that reduces function in one hemisphere change their view of the world. He's like, you don't have to be injured to have that experience. You just have to be out of balance. And you can start to view the world without the necessary corrective of both hemispheres' lenses on everything we're experiencing. So that's kind of at the core of his work. That stuff will show up in more detail probably as, you know, in my explorations in this community, because I'm like, And I feel like I'm in good company. Among other things, former Archbishop of Canterbury, name just went out of my head, really captivated by this guy's work as well. So there's interesting intersection here again between the work of a scientist and the work of a theologian. Always ground that intrigues me. One of the people who was interviewed in that documentary was an Indigenous scholar, past chancellor of University of British Columbia, and he beautifully illustrated this contrast between a worldview dominated by the calculating aspects of the left hemisphere with the worldview of someone from an Indigenous background that had been formed under different presuppositions. And in the documentary, he's answering the question, of the documentary maker, what happens in other cultures that have not privileged this left hemisphere kind of development? Does the brain still get out of balance? And the way he illustrated that, the way this indigenous scholar answered that question, was by saying that when an indigenous person talks about all my relations, they are not simply talking about other people. They're actually talking about everything. They're talking about the rocks and the trees and the lake and the sky and the animals, because it's all alive, it's all connected, it all has spirit, and we are part of that whole. If McGilchrist's on about something worth considering in our cultural context, is it any surprise that many of us who've grown up under those kind of emphases find ourselves intrigued by other, I'm going to say, more balanced views of the world? We're trying to correct something. Most of us have been trained in a very mechanistic view of the world, including a very mechanistic view of the brain. And if that's the kind of worldview we've been trained in, this can all sound really foreign. But I think that we can see, without really even straining our imaginations, that unless we start to understand that we are part of the whole, our extractive approach to life on this planet is going to make huge swaths of our home uninhabitable, by some accounts, as soon as the next 50 years. I was listening to an interview this week with the Prime Minister? I'm not entirely sure of the government structure. The government's top leader from the Maldives, the highest point of which is, what, a meter and a half above sea level or something like that? Very low-lying islands. Talking about the future of that nation if the sea goes up a couple of feet. And then this morning on the drive here, listening to another theorist just unload the numbers of how many people have been displaced by political unrest or conflict compared to how many people have already been displaced by climate shift. Climate shift is winning. We want to use that language. The number was bigger for climate shift. That's what I'm talking about. The core assumption of stage four is the same as what that indigenous elder described in that documentary. The core assumption of stage four is that we are all connected, that we are part of a greater whole. The implications of that are at once staggering and unfamiliar, and ancient and well-trodden. There is a reason why every substantial spiritual tradition, including the Christian tradition, insists that what we do to others is what we live with ourselves. In some traditions, it's a directive: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. In other traditions, it's a cautionary tale: don't do anything to others you wouldn't want done to you or yours. There are lots of different iterations, but at the core of all of them is the working assumption that everything is connected and that you can't pull on any piece of it without affecting the whole, including the rather everyday piece of how we treat one another. Stage four is the stage in this journey around doubt and faith where I think that starts to sink in a little deeper. It starts to penetrate our left brain dominated cultural values, including our so-called logical approach to things like systems of belief. And it starts to motivate and inform our quest to not only understand how everything is connected, but to begin to live as though that were actually true. For instance, this is often a stage where we start to look at the world of things like sacred and secular differently. We begin to see that things like awe and wonder are places that we can go to anytime and anywhere, and that we are surrounded by and ourselves embody what is sacred, and that this is true of everyone and everything. The list of things that we think of as things gets shorter in this stage as we understand that we are all animated by the same mystery. And not just we all humans, but we all everything. It can take some courage, and it can take some work to excavate that perspective, though, I think. Think back to the earliest moments of Nye's story about the airport, when that announcement asking anyone that understands Arabic to come to gate A4. And she writes, "Well, one pauses these days." I spent some time with that sentence before it clicked for me, because I haven't had the experience that Nye has had of being a person of visibly of Arabic descent living in the southern United States post 9/11. Would anyone that speaks some Arabic please come to gate A4? Well, one pauses these days. She's of Arab descent. She is in the airport in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and she is on her way to El Paso, Texas. And she knows, because she lives there, that her home country isn't always a great place to identify as Arabic. I love what she says next. "Well, gate A4 was my own gate. I went there." Damn. It's just like, oh. Anyway, what she finds, having made the effort, having taken the risk, is the sacrament of homemade mamul cookies and airline apple juice. The sacredness of a moment in which no one is apprehensive about the other. She finds, and is part of making, an expression of the shared world that she wants to live in. And she reminds us, not everything is lost, because this can still happen anywhere. I think that is incredibly beautiful. And from where I sit, deeply hopeful. And the best sort of reason to keep exploring what we believe. Not everything is lost, because this can still happen anywhere. Oh, yes.